This is Functional Medicine Update for March 2006, Volume 26, Number 3. In this month's issue, we'll be discussing the application of functional medicine to autoimmune disease. We'll begin by evaluating personalized medicine and the new technology for clinical evaluation of genetic makeup. We'll also cover reimbursement issues for predictive lab testing, chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome, oxidative stress linked to chronic fatigue syndrome symptoms, and hearing loss as a stress-induced disease. Our interview this month is with Dr. Jacob Kornberg. We'll be discussing functional medicine in clinical application. And we'll complete the March issue of 2006 with an overview of the functional medicine model, covering oxygen and water as therapeutic agents. Now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the March 2006 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
When we started the concept of functional medicine now nearly 20 years ago, as with any emerging concept, we had little idea where it would evolve to arrive in the year 2006. I think we're all very, very excited and impressed to see how it is caught and incubated and been nurtured by clinicians and researchers who have caught the concept and have added their own texture and flavor to it and have tried to create what I might call personalized preventive medicine, utilizing the functional medicine concept that personalizes the therapy to the individual need. This concept, of course, is very well described in the textbook of functional medicine, and I now have a hard copy in my hands. I'm actually holding it right now as I speak. This is like one of those holding the Rosetta Stone. It's a very sentient experience. It's quite a remarkable outgrowth of the collaborative work of literally hundreds of different researchers and clinicians and multiple authors that have given tirelessly to this project of putting together a true textbook on functional medicine. Some 800 pages in length, well in excess of 20,000 references, multiple authored, multiple edited, and multiple refereed. It represents, I think, the best of what these 20 years of evolution of functional medicine has been all about. I believe that this issue of Functional Medicine Update will hopefully keep the flame alive and burning and set us in the direction to go forward from 2006 to set the charting course for the next 10 years. Of course, you know we're heading on in preparation for our April 19th to 22nd, believe it or not, 13th symposium, International Symposium on Functional Medicine, which will be held in Tampa, Florida, as you know, on managing biotransformation, the metabolic, genomic, and detoxification balance points. This is one of the core principles, obviously, of the functional medicine concept, is understanding something about biotransformation and its inner relationship with detoxification. So I feel that the time that we've been spending the last few issues of Functional Medicine Update getting familiar with this concept has paid dividends in both preparation for the 13th International Symposium in Tampa, but also for the better understanding of how to properly use what we call the functional medicine matrix, the algorithm that allows these interconnections between different dysfunctions to arrive with patterns that then give rise to personalized therapies. Well, for years and years, I've been a registered clinical chemist and laboratory director and received, of course, the periodicals and the journals from the American Association for Clinical Chemistry, including each week a newsletter magazine from the AAAC entitled Clinical Laboratory News. And it was a sign to me of where the technology of medicine today is emerging to find itself and how that interrelates to the functional medicine concept when this last issue in the year of December 2005, the lead article was entitled The Challenges of Pharmacogenomic Tests or Has Personalized Medicine Arrived? And I found this to be a very, very interesting, different perspective on how we see functional medicine really from many different perspectives emerging to become a new concept that provides therapeutic opportunities for docs and ultimately their patients. So let me, if I can, just say how the AAAC sees personalized medicine arriving. They talk about the Food and Drug Administration in the January of 2005 period approving or clearing the Roche Molecular Systems AmpliChip cytochrome P450 genotyping test as a acceptable laboratory test, meaning a medical technology or instrument, a medical device that was approved. Many experts, as you know, when this was approved to allow the assessment of genomic uniqueness as it relates to detoxification, hailed this approval as the birth of a new era in personalized medicine that would make it actually accessible to the doc on the street, because now they would be evaluating unique detoxification principles of individual patients that would then be used for designing drug therapy, so that they would design around detoxification uniquenesses or blocks that might produce adverse side effects from specific drugs. The first pharmacogenomic microarray that was designed for this clinical application, the AmpliChip, was able, as you know, to detect specific genetic variations in these cytochrome P450 polymorphisms that then can provide information on how well an individual will be able to metabolize certain classes of drugs, thereby allowing the clinician ultimately to tailor drug therapies to the individual's genetic makeup. This is a huge breakthrough in the way that we see medicine and prescription, rather than just giving a dose of a drug based upon body surface area. What we're really talking about is the tailoring of drug therapy based upon the pharmacogenomics and the pharmacokinetics and dynamics of specific drugs and how they pass through the detoxification system, phase one and phase two. So this is what we might call managing biotransformation through detoxification at a very fundamental level, the genomic level. Roche released the chip for sale in the United States in June 2005, and labs have now started to take it up and use this technology for evaluating for clinicians the specific cytochrome P450 polymorphisms that individual patients have. As you probably know, there are a number of case precedent examples over the last 2 years in court of patients who brought suit against physicians for adverse responses they had to various medications, with the complaint that they had not been tested for specific detoxification abnormalities before the medications were administered, and their unique genetic polymorphisms did not allow them to metabolize the drug properly, and so they ended up having an adverse event, which they claimed was the responsibility of the physician for not having properly evaluated their uniqueness before they administered the medication. Now, this can greatly change prescribing patterns, obviously. It can greatly change the way medicine is practiced. Rather than looking at the massification of patients, assuming that all people are within certain acceptable standards of deviation relative to the way they metabolize a drug, now we're starting to emerge this personalization perspective that indicates that maybe patients need to be evaluated individually, because the difference from patient to patient based upon the experiment called pharmacotherapy may have different outcome based upon their polymorphisms of these detoxification enzymes. This, in a sense, is another way of coming through the door into the room of functional medicine, because what we're really saying is this is a tool to evaluate patient uniqueness, biochemical individuality, a genetic uniqueness that ultimately leads to a molecular medicine-based form of intervention, which is personalized medicine, the focus of functional medicine. So I find this to be a very interesting way that some physicians ultimately will lead themselves into looking at these functional medicine concepts. Most physicians obviously already recognize that not all patients respond similarly to certain drug therapies, but the label pharmacogenomic test may scare some docs, but it may also scare patients who might be worried about a test that examines their genetic makeup. Pharmacogenomics, as you know, because we've talked about it for over 10 years, is not a new concept. However, when we start talking about the specific application through the use of gene testing through these chip technologies, gene chip like the AmpliChip, then it leads to a new potential generalization of the concept. Pharmacogenomics gets more attention now because it has matured to the point where it can be used in a very practical sense to help ensure that safe and effective drugs are taken to the market. Personalized medicine obviously is somewhat of a catchphrase for the practice of clinical medicine that relies upon the ever-advancing science of both pharmacogenomics and pharmacogenetics. By the way, the difference between those two terms, in case you're not familiar with them, pharmacogenetics relates to the individual characteristic of that patient, whereas pharmacogenomics is the study of how differing polymorphisms influence differing metabolic outcomes. So one is kind of a general theme of the science of biotransformation and detoxification, that's pharmacogenomics, and the other is individualized to the patient who has had their own SNPs, their own single nucleotide polymorphisms evaluated. Pharmacogenetics, which is the role of this inheritance in inter-individual variation and drug response, and it's a primary inspiration for the type of research as a promise to individualized drug therapy. And so as we're starting to look at this, of course, we're doing it because it's been recognized that there are a lot more adverse drug reactions than maybe previously accounted for. This comes out of that study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that had reported that there are 2.2 million hospital events and up to 100,000 deaths per year annually in the U.S. as a consequence of hospital-based drug therapies due to ADRs. If there are that within the hospital environment where medications are given by professionals at the right, quote, dose to patients, then what could be the implication of ADRs in ambulatory patients? The labs that are bringing the AmpliChip in-house believe that it has the potential to bolster patient safety and will ultimately make it a very marketable test that undoubtedly virtually all physicians will ultimately be using. It uses polymerase chain reaction technology to detect variations in cytochrome P450 2D6 and 2C19 genes, which are those that are constitutional genes, not genes that have inducible characteristics that are very important in the metabolism of a number of different drug families. We now know that there are over 33 unique alleles or different potential variations on a theme for these two cytochrome P450 drug metabolism genes. The enzyme encoded by the 2D6 gene plays a primary role in the metabolism of drugs used to treat depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, cardiovascular disease that is treated with beta blockers, attention deficit hyperactivity disorders, so this may have a relationship to kids and how they respond to various medications. While the enzyme produced from the cytochrome P450 2C19 gene metabolizes many anticonvulsants, proton pump inhibitors, so you talk about esophageal reflux disorders, benzodiazepines, and antimalarials. The AmpliChip CYP450 test ultimately provides a predictive phenotype for patients and ranks them into four categories: poor metabolizers, intermediate metabolizers, extensive metabolizers, or ultra-rapid metabolizers. Obviously, those that are slow or poor metabolizers, a certain dose of the drug may build a higher tissue or plasma level, produce toxicity, whereas those that are ultra-fast metabolizers or ultra-rapid metabolizers, the same dose may be rapidly cleared from the body and have no therapeutic outcome of importance. So you need to obviously then be looking at how these patients might be transiting these agents through their cytochrome P450 systems. This is an exact application of what we'll be speaking to at the 13th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, talking about managing biotransformation because of this wide range of genetic characteristics associated with detoxification. So I think that what we're actually looking at is developing an effective means of therapeutic drug monitoring and looking at individualizing patient therapies. And of course, this leads to predictive testing as it contrasts to pathology testing. And for years, we've talked about the use of the laboratory for evaluating patient status. And the tests that have traditionally been used for multiphasic screening are tests that really are designed to evaluate pathology. Tests like liver enzyme profiles, the OTs and PTs, or the measure glucose tolerance, which really measures the presence of diabetes like glucose and insulin, or lipid disorders like cholesterol and triglycerides, or kidney problems like blood urea, nitrogen, and creatinine levels. So what we're talking about in this case is use of the laboratory for predicting the onset of disorders. Now, to some extent, cholesterol testing is a predictive analyte because it does have a focus on understanding the prognostic potential for later stage vascular events. So this may be considered the first analyte that arrived on the multiphasic screening profile as a predictive analyte, having more preventive rather than disease diagnostic capabilities. The cytochrome P450 genetic polymorphism would not be necessarily called prognostic, but would certainly be considered predictive because they tell us a little bit about how that individual, based upon their genetic uniqueness, will respond to certain agents, exogenous and endogenous agents, that require detoxification through those specific enzyme pathways. So I think this is the birthing of a new concept. It goes beyond psychiatry, it goes beyond clinical pharmacology, into looking at how people respond to their environment in general, because these same detoxification enzyme systems that are used for the metabolism of specific drugs are also those that are used for the detoxification and clearance of environmental toxins, endogenous substances produced by secondary metabolism of bacteria in the gut, and other secondary chemicals that come as a consequence of liver and cellular function. So I think that this is an excitement about how we will see the emergence of a new science that will develop around pharmacogenomics, which is part of the functional medicine model. There are a few hurdles that will challenge the rapid spread of this testing. These are not unexpectedly related to reimbursement issues, because there's been a question as to whether there should be insurance reimbursement allowed for the evaluation of cytochrome P450 polymorphisms. It seems, again, quite interesting, doesn't it, that we're very quick to want to reimburse for pathology-based tests, but very resistant in reimbursing for predictive tests, when the predictive tests may allow for the prevention of a disorder that requires the necessity for evaluating pathology and intervening for treating pathology, which is very expensive and may be hospital-based. Again, these are philosophical questions that need to be addressed so that functional medicine and predictive and personalized medicine will ultimately take their place as important parts of the healthcare delivery system. We have, obviously, a very highly evolved disease care delivery system, and almost all the incentives and motivations are to financially and physically support the disease care delivery system. We have a much more primitive, predictive, prevention-oriented healthcare delivery system. And that's, of course, what we've been speaking about in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update, when we talk about chronic disease and the need for a new clinical education and new assessment technologies for evaluating individuals who are on a trajectory towards later stage, more acute disease. And, of course, how then we reimburse for that and how the business is established, the medical industrial complex that supports that of predictive, preventive, and personalized medicine. So there is certainly no lack of excitement among those who design and perform these pharmacogenomic types of evaluations. As the testing expands and focuses on more application-specific panels that include genes beyond metabolism, like genes associated with transport and reception, so you start looking at receptor and ligand interactions, enthusiasm will rise outside to ultimately become a major theme in laboratory testing. Ultimately, pharmacogenomics will be, I believe, a very big driver for converting a medicine into a predictive, personalized form of medicine. And I think that that will, ironically, be one of the ways that biochemical individuality and the concepts of functional medicine get incorporated into a more traditionally based pathology-focused medical practice. Of course, there will be always these syndromes that don't fit nicely into a tidy diagnostic silo, maybe then relegated into the borders between or in among various disease diagnostic criteria. One of those is that which we call the syndrome, chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia syndrome. And the reason that we put the descriptor syndrome rather than disease on these conditions is that they don't fall into a very nice, clean fit with the diagnostic criteria to lend them to an ICD-9 diagnostic code. So does that mean that they don't really exist? Are they not real clinical entities because we can't get our arms around them and cleanly define them based upon pathophysiological assessment, and therefore, if we can't define it, we can't name it, we think it doesn't really exist? Well, I think patients who have chronic fatigue syndrome or who have fibromyalgia syndrome would say that it does exist, it's real, and of course, physicians who have seen patients with this assessment and the syndrome or these syndromes certainly are aware of the fact that this is a real clinical entity. It doesn't mean that we absolutely understand the origin, and in fact, the origin of these disorders may be models for 20th century dysfunctions of a chronic nature because they are multifactorial in origin. They do not have one specific etiology. They are related to imbalances of the neuroendocrine immune system, as are many of the immunological problems that we see today that ultimately may later go on to be called autoimmune diseases of various types, thyroiditis, or inflammatory bowel disease, colitis, or things that resemble systemic lupus erythematosus. So there is this complex kind of milieu of dysfunctions that are related to the nervous system, the immune system, and the endocrine system that have inflammatory relationships that we're not exactly sure what to call them because they don't fit into a very clean, tidy diagnostic criterion. Well, with that in mind, let's look at things like chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivity, and fibromyalgia syndrome. As you probably know, we interviewed Dr. Martin Paul as a researcher of the month many years ago in Functional Medicine Update, professor of biochemistry and basic medical sciences at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington. Dr. Paul, that's P-A-L-L, had described to us the work that he had been doing in trying to put together a comprehensive understanding of the etiology of MCS, multiple chemical sensitivity, fibromyalgia syndrome, and chronic fatigue syndrome, knowing that they share much in common, as was reported by Dr. Deidre Buchwald in an article that she and her colleagues authored a number of years ago. We also interviewed one of Dr. Buchwald's colleagues on chronic fatigue syndrome about 2 years ago in Functional Medicine Update, and she described the multiple symptomatologies that patients present with CFS that overlap with both FMS, fibromyalgia, and with multiple chemical sensitivities, suggesting that there is a shared common etiology among this. It was actually way back in March of 1999 that Dr. Paul first brought this to our attention in Functional Medicine Update, and now some 7 years later, we're starting to get a better understanding of how things like Gulf War syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivity, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome interrelate through kind of a common paradigm, what we call a vicious cycle, a feed-forward cycle. Well, this feed-forward cycle has to do with activation of the nitric oxide, peroxynitrite, oxidative stress pathway, the intervention and interrelationship then with activation of the immune system to produce then inflammatory mediators, including interleukin-1, beta, IL-6, TNF-alpha, interferon gamma, how that then interrelates as a dog chasing its tail with the stimulation of the production of nuclear factor kappa B as a transcription factor that controls gene expression patterns associated with the upregulation of these inflammatory mediators, and how that all feeds onto itself to keep perpetuating the problem. So it's different than an infectious disorder that when a person gets over the infection and their body's immune system has successfully won the battle with that organism, that they'll get well. In the case of a chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, multiple chemical sensitivity patient, there's a re-initiation and a re-stimulation of the condition through these feed-forward cycles that occur through oxidative stress-related mediation and upregulation of the immune system. So when we look at how to diagnose and treat FMS, CFS, and MCS, it leads us into the concept of neuroendocrine immune functional medicine web-like balancing. It requires a complex approach that deals with the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. It deals with detoxification. It deals with gut function. It deals with oxidative stress. It deals with immune stabilization of thymus-dependent 1 and thymus-dependent 2 activities. So it is a classic example of personalized medicine focused on the web, which is the algorithm that's taught as the central teaching and therapeutic clinical tool in functional medicine. We know that there are various receptors that have been identified to be associated with activation in these complex immune, endocrine, and neurological conditions. And these receptors become activated by their ligands under conditions that are associated with chronic inflammation and oxidative shifts in physiology. In a recent paper in Free Radical Biology and Medicine in 2005, this is actually volume 39, page 584, investigators from the Vascular Disease Research Unit at Ninewells Hospital in Dundee, Scotland, reported that the etiology of chronic fatigue syndrome, although unknown, is emerging to be related to these oxidative stress kinds of phenomena because one sees in these patients fairly high levels of 8-isoprostane F2 alpha, which, as you probably know, these isoprostanes are related to free radical oxidative injury to unsaturated lipids in situ, and it's a measure of real-time oxidative stress. So CFS patients had very high levels of these isoprostanes, and in fact, the degree of CFS symptoms correlated with the level of isoprostanes. This is the first time it seems that there has been a very strong clinical association between in vivo oxidative stress and the CFS symptoms. Now, if you say, well, where do these CFS symptoms come from and where does the oxidative stress come from? Again, it comes from this feed-forward cycle that Dr. Paul spoke about as it relates to the activation of the immune and neurological systems. through various receptor ligand interactions. Some of these ligand receptor interactions are precipitated by the production of various types of secondary metabolites through inappropriate detoxification. One of those is activation of the valinoid receptor as a putative target of the first chemicals in multiple chemical sensitivity. So we're starting to see, as was reported by Dr. Paul and his colleague Julius Anderson in the Archives of Environmental Health, this is volume 59, page 363, that activation of specific receptors can in fact induce some of these reactions that lead to feed-forward cycles of oxidative stress, immune upregulation, inflammation, and the perpetuation of the symptoms of MCS. The valinoid receptor can be activated by things like mycotoxins, for instance, may account for the sick Billings syndrome associated with MCS, and various other types of volatile organic solvents and chemicals and endogenous chemicals that can do this as well, that can activate the neurological system through the NMDA receptor activation. So this is why we see such diffuse symptoms in chronic fatigue syndrome, including neurological symptoms, immunological symptoms, cutaneous symptoms, endocrine symptoms. These are all interrelated to the alteration of physiology that occurs by teasing the web, pulling the web into the state of chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, immunological imbalance, endocrine disturbance. And so now we start to see what doesn't look like a disease. It looks more like a syndrome. It presents in multiple forms and in multiple ways in differing patients. So what's the treatment of choice? That's a very good question. And obviously, because there are multiple etiological components, a single drug is probably not going to be the answer. And in fact, what we would think about from a functional medicine perspective is personalizing the therapy to the individual's need based upon the perturbation of their own individual web. By looking in the matrix, that's the teaching tool for functional medicine, we would look at gut-related immune function, we'd look at oxidative stress, we'd look at neuroendocrine function, we would look at immunological function, we would look, obviously, at how the body-mind relationship was influencing in the neuroendocrine immune system, and ultimately from this, a personalized treatment based upon both the genetic uniqueness of the patient, their antecedents and personal past history would be developed that would become their management program. So it leads us into recognizing that the functional medicine approach for the management of chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivity, what has euphemistically been called Gulf War syndrome, would be that that uses the specific focus on their algorithm that derives out of their web, out of their matrix. So you would have a focus on gastrointestinal function. You would look at the immune function as it arises out of gastrointestinal disturbances. You'd look at the effects on oxidative stress. You'd look at the effects on a neuroendocrine function. You would look at the effects of body-mind and how stress may play a role in the mitigation in that individual patient of their symptoms. And you would recognize that there are common themes that would be emerging by asking the right questions in the patient's story to design a personalized program for their intervention. It doesn't fit into a specific singular intervention. So when a person says, give me the algorithm for the treatment of chronic fatigue syndrome, there is not a treatment. There is a general principle as it relates to the etiology and the mechanisms of action and these feed-forward cycles for which then the specific treatment plan would be designed for that individual patient based upon their matrix evaluation. So this is the tool of the functional medicine model. This is the outcome that is described in a textbook of functional medicine. I think that it's a very different model than just tidally diagnosing a disease and using a singular treatment algorithm for that diagnosis. It requires a little bit more thoughtful approach towards patient management. You have to listen to the story and you have to develop the response to the story. But the outcome in these complex symptom-related clusters that we call syndromes may be much more profound in positive outcome than just trying to pound a round peg in a square hole and get a singular diagnosis. With that in mind, let's just take one other example that I think illustrates this matrix functional medicine model. And that's related to the auditory system and hearing loss. As we are an aging population, hearing loss is becoming more prevalent in our society. And also in younger people, we're starting to see loss of hearing as a consequence of trauma to the auditory system, sensory trauma through things like very loud music with headphones or earplugs and the continued overstimulation of auditory tracts. So you might ask, how does this at all relate to functional medicine? This appears to be a pretty esoteric connection to functional medicine. But actually, what's emerging through the basic understanding of the mechanism of hearing loss is that there is a functional medicine connection. As you know, there are some drugs that are now available to ameliorate predictable damaging effects of excessive noise and ototoxic substances. But the real question is, where does this come from? What is the actual source of the physiology of hearing loss? And I think that's a very interesting question, because what has emerged is that part of the problem is related to, believe it or not, the activation of the oxidative stress machinery within the very sensitive organs of the auditory neurological system. Let me just, if I can, back up for a second and give you just some review. As you know, noise is the greatest environmental causative factor among the defined etiology of hearing loss. Traditionally, prevention of noise-induced hearing loss has been addressed by providing wearable hearing protection and reducing noise emissions. According to the National Institutes for Deafness and Communication Disorders and the American Speech, Language, and Hearing Association, as well as OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, between 30 and 40 million Americans are exposed to hazardous sound or noise levels on a regular basis that can injure hearing. There are about 10 to 15 million people that have been estimated of all age groups in the USA who presently have hearing loss as a consequence of noise induction. There are many noisy occupations, including construction, manufacturing, mining, forestry, farming, aviation, trucking, military, and, as I said earlier, recreational exposure to high noise levels through music and other types of auditory devices. So when we start looking at the prevalence of this as a functional condition, it's very high. So then we say, what's the pathogenesis? Well, as you know, in response to sound waves traveling through the cochlea, the auditory hairs in the organ of Corti depolarize following the opening of channels caused by the physical deflection of the cilia. The organ of Corti contains two types of auditory hair cells, the inner and outer hair cells. They're organized into three rows and are usually the first hair cells affected. Healthy members of the organ of Corti contract in response to acoustic stimulation, resulting into an increased sensitivity at about 40 to 50 decibels. Now, here's where we get into some interesting functional medicine physiology. Mitochondria are some of the first and most effective intracellular organelles in the models of noise-induced hearing loss. These inter-hairs are predominantly sensory in nature and are heavily innervated by the eighth cranial auditory nerve. The constitutive array of these very fine structures is dramatic given our noisy environments, and ultimately can overstimulate then the activation of these cells that then produces constant depolarization of mitochondria, leading to what might be called metabolic exhaustion, with the accumulation of reactive oxygen and reactive nitrogen species. When this happens over a long period of time, obviously you get into an oxidative stress situation, and this leads to apoptosis of the cell, or death. The cell undergoes cell death, and you start losing then neuronal reserve, which is associated with a proper reserve for hearing. Over the past decade, much progress has been made in the understanding of actually the cellular and biochemical basis of noise-induced hearing loss. And we now recognize how these are associated with the formation of free radicals, particularly the reactive and oxygen and nitrogen species, that ultimately overwhelm resonant detoxification and antioxidant mechanisms, showing that even in hearing, antioxidation and detoxification become very important as control points for resistance against environmental pressure, in this case, noise. A major intracellular antioxidant pathway that detoxifies free radicals and attenuates reactive oxygen species is that glutathione pathway in these sensitive hearing structures. Loud noise can reduce glutathione levels and increase the level of oxidized glutathione in the inner ear, leaving it prone to both reactive oxygen and reactive nitrogen species-mediated cell damage. Glutathione interacts with glutathione peroxidase, catalyzing the ability of glutathione to act as an antioxidant and detoxifies free radicals. The additive effect of increased reactive oxygen species and reactive nitrogen species, as well as the depletion of antioxidant capacity through the loss of GSH, glutathione, leads to cell injury or death. You then start seeing the buildup of peroxynitrite, the same chemical I described earlier when I was discussing chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivities, and fibromyalgia, a toxic byproduct of activation of the immune system and activation of oxidative stress. These free radicals degrade lipids and damage membrane-bound organelles such as mitochondria and nuclei, and ultimately lead to permanent loss or injury of hair cells. So that leads then to, what is otoprotection? What would be a functional medicine approach other than just removing the noise, which is obviously a part of the reduction of the antecedents, but what may be also some of the other things that could lower injury? Recent studies with antioxidants, including N-methyl-D-aspartate antagonists, capsaicin or cell death inhibitors, and growth factors, have shown significant preliminary results. The one, however, part of this research that seems most interesting are compounds that influence glutathione, such as glutathione precursors, N-acetylcysteine and methionine. N-acetylcysteine, or NAC as it's sometimes been abbreviated, is a glutathione prodrug, as you know, that upon deacetylation then enhances glutathione production. High oral doses of NAC is FDA approved as a mucolytic agent for respiratory diseases and can reverse acute hepatotoxicity following acetaminophen overdoses. It is usually given orally at the levels of something on the order of 50 to 70 milligrams per kilogram, and this can enhance then intracellular glutathione levels. There are then things that have been used to try to accentuate the N-acetylcysteine activity, including N-acetyl carnitine and magnesium and coenzyme Q10 as additional oral agents for helping to protect against noise-induced hearing loss. Magnesium, in a double-blind placebo-controlled study involving 300 young healthy military recruits who were supplemented with 4 grams of oral magnesium per day, showed significantly less noise-induced injury than those who were exposed to the same noise but did not get magnesium but got placebo. Similarly, with coenzyme Q10, at doses of 100 milligrams per day, there was a significant reduction in the loss of hearing upon exposure to noise. So what we're starting to see is that the functional medicine model at the cellular physiological level even comes to what we might consider a strict environmental problem, noise-induced hearing loss, and that, again, we have to go back to fundamental mechanisms and understand physiology and cellular activity. By the way, what I've just been describing is well-reviewed in a recent article in a journal called DDT, Volume 10, page 1291 in 2005. There's a very nice review of a number of approaches towards reduction of ototoxicity, with the principal focus on lowering oxidative stress and increasing detoxification of free radicals. So I hope you can see from these discussions that our topic in the 13th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, to be held April 19th through 22nd, is not singular in its focus. So when we talk about managing transformation and the detoxification balance points, we're looking across many different clinical conditions. We're tying together genomics with environmental exposures and trying to design a personalized program for individuals who may not even understand that they have symptoms that are related to the alteration in biotransformation and detoxification. Well, that's a nice lead into our clinician of the month that I think you're going to be, as I, very, very excited to listen to, who comes with a broad range of over 30 years experience in medicine that can talk to this specific topic.
You know, I look forward to this each month because I learn so much from hearing from the experiences of experts, what their kind of get real experience has been with applications and concepts of functional medicine. And we're certainly not going to be disappointed this month in that our clinician of the month is Dr. Jack Kornberg. Jack has been a good friend and colleague now in the Institute of Functional Medicine and our Functional Medicine Research Center for the last couple of years, but he has an extraordinarily interesting background bringing him up to the 206 year, both personally and professionally. He got his undergraduate degree from the University of California at Los Angeles and then later his medical doctorate degree from the University of California at Irvine College of Medicine in 1969. Did an internship at LA County General Medical Center, then returned to the University of California, Irvine, and finished a 4-year surgical residency in 1974. He then served 2 years in the U.S. Navy as a surgeon in Corpus Christi, Texas, and he and his wife Peggy, who is a nurse, and their 2 children then finally resided in Puyallup, Washington, this beautiful gateway to our lovely Mount Rainier here in the Pacific Northwest. This was back in 1976. And he established a very successful general surgery practice working with his wife, a nurse, and highly respected in our local medical community. He was certified by the American Board of Surgery in 75, elected to the American College of Surgeons in 79, and during his years of surgical practice was at Good Samaritan Hospital, served many years as the chairman of the Quality Assurance Committee and the Surgical Committee. He's been elected the president of the medical staff for 2 years when he was there at the hospital and was a graduate of our Applied Functional Medicine and Clinical Practice Training Program of the IFM and started to incorporate functional medicine into his surgical practice. And, of course, I'm going to ask him how a surgeon goes into becoming a functional medicine practitioner. That seems maybe to some of you as an anachronism. In 2003, he decided actually to give up his surgical practice, somewhat to the shock of his wife, as I recall, and created the Center for Health Awareness and Integrated Holistic Medical Clinic in Tacoma, Washington. So this is a very big step for a highly respected general surgeon. And now he's lectured internationally on health and wellness and has been seeing patients at our Functional Medicine Research Center. So that's just a short little thumbnail review of the texture and color from a professional perspective of Dr. Kornberg. But, Jack, there's much more to you than just those few words. So we really welcome you to Functional Medicine Update. And I guess my first question, obviously, is, what the heck led you to make this extraordinary change in your career from being a highly successful general surgeon into a functional medicine doctor?
Well, good morning, Jeff. Thank you. It was interesting because being a surgeon, and especially being the older surgeon of our community, I used to get a lot of patients that had abdominal pain, and they were sent to me with actually the diagnosis of adhesions. The concept was that they needed another surgery to help them with their abdominal discomfort. And as I listened to their story, it became very obvious to me that this was not a surgical problem. This was a functional problem. But at that time, I didn't have any type of framework in which to work them up or to put this into perspective. So I was at the operating table one time just complaining about how all these patients with multiple surgeries were being sent back for surgery. And one of our anesthesiologists used to be a student of yours, and he said, you have got to go find Dr. Jeff Bland, and you have to go listen to him talk, and he will probably be able to give you an insight as to what's going on with these patients. And so I did. I attended a couple of your lectures, and, of course, my brain got melted in those days. But once I started to understand about the concept of functional medicine and that these patients really did not have an anatomical defect that needed surgery, they had a functional problem with their GI tract, I was able to start incorporating this into my practice. What actually happened was towards the last year of my practice, I started actually sending more patients away that I thought did not need surgery than patients that did surgery on. And so, of course, that's not very appropriate for a surgeon. And finally, Peggy and I just decided that I couldn't, like, straddle the fence. I couldn't really be a functional medicine person and do surgery. And things had changed in surgery in the 30 years I was a surgeon. It was no longer fun. I'm sure a lot of the physicians who have been in standard medicine know that things have changed as far as paperwork and litigation. So we made the jump to just decide to give up surgery and to practice functional medicine. I had to take, of course, lots of classes and courses, and I took the AFMCP course twice, and now I love what I do. I didn't want to give up medicine, but again, it was time to move on from surgery into something new and exciting, and it really has been. This practice has just grown, and just amazing how we've been able to impact and how we've been able to help guide people back to health in a system that is not geared, even though we call it health system, is not geared to health. So it's been very rewarding.
Well, that's obviously the most exciting kind of story that we love to hear, because it's the raison d'etre for the Institute for Functional Medicine, is to try to provide these opportunities for, as David Jones says, the doctor re-enchant him or herself with medicine. So congratulations both to you and Peggy for taking the plunge, and I'm sure on behalf of your patients, a big thanks. So I know that at the Functional Medicine Research Center, which you've been giving a day of your time each week, you've been seeing patients with what are euphemistically called autoimmune disorders, and this might be, again, another interesting stretch for a traditionally trained surgeon to now be working in the area of autoimmune disorders, but you might tell us a little bit from the experience you've had over the last year in seeing these patients with complex immunological imbalances, what your perspective is as it emerged around this category of conditions that we call autoimmune disease.
Yes, I think you're right. And I think a lot of practitioners are probably overwhelmed, you know, by some of the stories and some of the patients and their physical findings when they meet a patient with autoimmune disease. It encompasses, you know, over 100 different types of diagnoses. And I actually sat down and I said, you know, we really have a lot of tools that we learned from functional medicine that can help us approach autoimmune disease differently than probably the traditional approach. Well, I think one of the problems with the traditional approach is autoimmune disease is a systemic disease, yet it has been chopped up into little pieces by the various specialties. So the GI guide deals with inflammatory bowel disease. The neurologist deals with MS, myasthenia gravis. The orthopod will deal with some of the bone issues. The rheumatologist will deal with lupus. And yet, to me, what we've seen is this is just, it's one disease. It's been artificially chopped up into small pieces. I love that story, I mean, of the blind Chinese man trying to figure out what an elephant is by just feeling one little part. And so it's, from the traditional perspective, I don't think you get a 10,000-foot view of what autoimmune disease is. But from a functional medicine point of view, you can. I mean, we make the assumption that autoimmune disease is a systemic disease. You make the assumption this is a multifactorial disease. From the functional medicine point of view, we look at chronic disease differently. We look at it from the perspective, okay, what are the predisposing factors? What are the things that the patient brings from their past that create some susceptibility to a certain disease? And then we look at the triggers. And then we look at the mediators of what's going on today that keeps the disease going. And it's very interesting. Some of these people will, for example, have three people in the family have a viral infection. And then they're the only one that never gets better. They'll give you the story that, you know, since I got that mononucleus, I got something, I've never been the same. And it's interesting that they have some type of susceptibility that singles them out to become susceptible to autoimmune disease. Now, the multifactorial concept is really very appropriate for a functional medicine approach. Because we do. We have, from our training, we have this web of connectivity. We believe, you know, so all the balances and all the functions in the body are interconnected. And so when I approach autoimmune disease, I have that picture in my mind. When I try to take the story of the patient and translate this story into physiology and biology, what's really happening, I use the tools that I was trained with functional medicine to kind of frame what's going on so that I can make sense of it. And what I have found is that these diseases don't start just when the patient has a diagnosis. Most of the times, the patients we have seen at the research center, they have a long, long history of what I call inflammatory process going on. They usually have a family history of other members of the family having different types or maybe even the same autoimmune disease. But actually, it's interesting, most of the time it's not the same autoimmune disease. A relative will have, a sister will have lupus, and they'll have rheumatoid arthritis, or somebody will have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and they'll have some type of inflammatory bowel disease. But most of these patients come with some type of genetic susceptibility that you can pick up from the history. Stress seems to be a really big thing. So I put it there at the top. The mind-body connection seems to be really important. It's interesting to me, Jeff, that we are not smart enough in our stressful lives to stop behaviors that are destroying us. But the body is smart enough. And it's just interesting, from my own perspective, a lot of times the body will stop the patient from doing an activity which is extremely stressful to the body, whether it's work, whether it's being the super mom, you know, the soccer mom, whatever. And it's just kind of interesting that when they come to the clinic, we have to recognize that, because if you don't change this environmental input, we probably will not have an impact on changing the disease. So we look at the antecedents, things that the patient has in their past. Then we look at the triggering episodes, and they can be anything. And it's really interesting, the same autoimmune disease can have multiple triggers. A lot of people will swear that they started after a viral infection. Some people say it started after a trauma, such as an automobile accident, or even a mental trauma, such as a divorce or a significant death or something in the family. It could be after a certain medication. The stories are just as varied as the number of people, but as a functional medicine physician, that doesn't bother you. You just put the pieces together. You kind of like peel the onion down to the core thing that's going on. And eventually, you will get to the mediators or the processes which are going on in the body right now to maintain the disease. Now, in autoimmune disease, it's really complex. You can get into the CD4 versus CD8 ratios and TH1, TH2. I love that quote from Martin Fisher. He just says the patient doesn't really care about the science. He wants to know if he can be cured. And so I think from a functional medicine point of view, the intricacies of all the various processes going on are interesting, but the key is, what can we do to impact the disease?
That's a great segue, because you've defined a different playing field, a different domain for the functional medicine perspective. And so what would you call the perimeter goalposts or the outline of your field? What are the types of things from a clinical perspective that become part of your toolkit?
It is as varied as that web, because I think that all of the areas that we look at can have an impact onto autoimmune disease. We know a few of them. To me, being a surgeon, I always go to the gut. We've been taught that the gut has a very large percent of the immune function of the body in the gall. And so one of the things which I immediately evaluate is GI function, GI balance. It's interesting that in our study of our 20 patients that we've done at the research center, four of these patients actually had celiac disease and didn't even know they had it, and actually had no symptoms. But they had some of the highest numbers we found in antibodies to gliadin and transglutaminase. So the gut is a very, to me, is a very important place that I start my evaluation. I use stool analysis, we use food antibody panels, and now we actually, on almost every patient, now doing a celiac panel, because this has just cropped up so many times. Again, it's kind of hit us from the side because we didn't have any real GI symptoms leading us to believe the patient had celiac disease. But all these things upregulate the patient's immune system. Other things which I look at immediately, since most of these patients, I think we only had one male, and that was with Crohn's disease, and all the other patients we had were females, is the whole concept of where does estrogen metabolism fit into this disease. And I use some of the tools that we have of looking at the ratio of metabolism of the 2-hydroxy and 16-hydroxyestrone as an indicator whether there is something on the estrogen side that is stimulating, again, this process. And studies have shown that patients with autoimmune disease tend to have higher 16-hydroxyestrones, and patients that do not seem to have these diseases have a higher 2-hydroxy. So this whole concept of estrogen metabolism is very important, and the tools that we use to measure this I use in our office, and most of my patients actually have a problem. I think we had about 75% of the patients seem to have a very high 16-hydroxyestrone level, and we needed to address that and modulate their metabolism.
That kind of relates in general to the concept of altered detoxification,
yeah,
because estrogen is metabolized principally through liver cytochrome P450. So I'm wondering, do you see correlations at all with other types of imbalances of detoxification capability?
Yes, we do. We have seen that. From the gut perspective, being one of the largest containers of toxic materials, we look at bowel function, constipation, we look at methylation, we look at a lot of these parameters in our workup and use the data to try to tailor specific things. Now, these things normally I usually do after our initial evaluation. in the research center, it was really neat because we had a fairly nice budget. We can go down and just have a whole long list of tests that you could do that usually ended up costing the patient several thousand dollars. But in real practice, you have to pay attention to where you think you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck. So to me, that's where having this framework of functional medicine, so you can go down to the history and you can figure out, okay, where do I think I'm going to get the most influence on this complex system from the patient's history? That approach, which I learned from the AFMCP, has been awesome because some patients, it'll become very obvious that it's a GI tract. Other patients, are very obvious that they're toxic. And they could be toxic from, I've had several patients toxic from heavy metals. In my practice, it hasn't been a high thing, but you have to be aware of it. It's interesting. Most of these patients have a vitamin D deficiency problem. There's literature that says that vitamin D is a very pivotal, important component in modulating and actually slowing down the autoimmune response. And so we're finding that most of our patients have vitamin D levels in the 20s and even in the teens. And so to me, that's another tool. It's a very important part of this picture when you put it together.
I just want to comment just for the listener that when you're talking vitamin D levels, I presume you're talking about 25-hydroxyvitamin D3.
Correct, that's correct.
Yeah, good. Just so when they'll know what to order to assess vitamin
right.
D status.
To me, even in my private practice, I'm actually using that. It's almost like a standard test now. It's a little pricey, but it's amazing how many times it is abnormal. So I've included it as almost my base test that I do for people with autoimmune disease.
I know that you've had some extraordinary experiences with various patients. Maybe you could tell us one or two that might exemplify what you're describing.
I'd love to. You know, in our Tacoma paper, just as we started, it's amazing how all these things come together. There was an article about a disease called erythromelalgia. And this is a rare disease. It's a disease that's exactly opposite from Raynaud's syndrome. In Raynaud's, you get constriction of the blood vessels and you get cold hands, and the fingertips turn white. In erythromelalgia, you get dilatation of the microvasculature, so they get very hot feet or hot hands and very painful. So there was this article that came out in the paper just exactly the same week that this patient came to me with erythromelalgia. And the article was just saying the pain that nobody can deal with, and they had a picture of the lady showing her with 20 and 30 pills, and still she said she was in constant pain. So when this patient came in with this disease, nothing like being challenged, you know, as being a surgeon. Somebody says, you can't do it, of course, you have to. So I said, okay, let's take her on. Because it's kind of rare, and you might say, well, why would you want to do a rare disease? Because this lady was in constant pain. She had not put on tennis shoes or shoes for 5 years. She had not really been able to walk for 2 or 3 years. And it actually took them 5 years to even find the diagnosis. So in her workup, she was positive ANA. And she had, let me see here, she had a couple other things that were interesting. She was on Neurontin, she was on Celexa, she was on lots of medications for the discomfort and the pain. Essentially, her physical examination was negative, except the fact that when she was not having these extremely hot fingers and feet, they were actually cool to the touch. So it seemed like the whole thermoregulatory system was kind of reversed. And she had a very low vitamin D level. Interesting, we did a genetic testing on her because it's just one of the things we've been trying to do. And she had a polymorphism in tumor necrosis factor alpha, which means she has an upregulation of her immune system. And she also had an interleukin 10, which means she has a downregulation in the dampening effect of interleukin 10. So all her life she's had different problems with allergies, she's had problems with eczema, she's had problems with one type of inflammatory process as another, because she's carried these polymorphisms with her since birth, and it was just kind of interesting to put this all together. So she has a family history, multiple surgeries. I put this whole together. As far as antecedents, she had a family history of allergies, she had these genetic polymorphisms, she actually had an abusive childhood with a lot of emotional baggage, she had repeated antibiotic use in the past. She did not eat well, so she had nutritional deficiencies. She She had some back and neck trauma, multiple surgeries, IBS. And then if you look at what could have been the triggers, well, she had environment allergens. She had obviously problems with the antibiotics and gut microbes. She had endogenous toxins. The temperature of the environment was a trigger for her. And then the mediators, of course, you can just list all the interleukins and signaling molecules and cytokines. So what did we do with this lady? Interesting, we put her on an anti-inflammatory medical food and added to this a product that had things that we knew helped modulate the immune system. We had selenium, we had zinc, we had isoalpha acids from hops, and that's all we did at the beginning. And immediately, the first couple of weeks, she reported that she had a 50% improvement in her symptoms, less fatigue, and she noticed that other pains, like in her shoulder, that she hadn't even paid attention, had decreased. We then got a lab back, so we knew that she was low in vitamin D, so we added that. We added some omega-3 fatty acids. She had an elevated homocysteine, so we thought that she might have some problems with methylation, so we added some B12 and folate to her regime. And then we put her on an elimination diet. And by the fifth week, she had 100% reduction in the pain of her feet and her hands. She was the first time in 3 years she was able to open up a jar. Her migraines, which she had had, were now gone. She was able to sleep. And she had resolution of her intestinal gas. Now, by the fifth week, we got back her stool analysis, and she had very, very high calprotectin and very, very high eosinophil proteins. And so that's when we got the celiac panel on her, and she was one of the highest. And she actually didn't know that she was celiac, but she was. She was already on an elimination diet. We put her on a celiac diet. Her eosinophilic proteins were over 31, and her calprotectin was over 250. She had no growth of lactobacillus or bifidobacterium, and she had 4-plus proteus. So we put her on the 4-R program to try to rebuild, to re-inoculate, to remove pathogens, and replace digestive function. She continued to make great improvements, and actually by about the eighth week, she had taken herself off almost all of her medications. She was down to only 3 tablets of Neurontin per day rather than the 9, and she said, quote, "I feel like I'm 20 years younger." And that was really cool, because this is the same disease that the paper had said, the newspaper had written, that nobody could help. And here, with just using the functional medicine tools that we have, just simple tools, we were able to make a major, major impact in this lady's life. She went on to, eventually by the 12th week, to get off all of her medications. She was able to stand for the first time in years for a long time. She actually started to put shoes on. And when I just saw her recently, she says, "You won't believe what I've done. I went to the mall in tennis shoes." Now, she hadn't done that for 6 to 7 years. And all of her abdominal symptomatology, she actually didn't realize how much abdominal symptomatology, the bloating and stuff, that had all gone away. By the 12th week, the laboratory work showed that her eosinophil proteins had come down to almost 18. Her calprotectin was down to 35 from 250. She had bifidobacter growing. She had lactobacillus growing. And her intestinal permeability was actually coming back towards normal. Her homocysteine had come down from 9 down to 4. Her vitamin D was still a little low, so we increased that. But here's a lady who was being told by her physician, be prepared for a lifelong pain of not being able to wear shoes, of not being able to do the things you love to do. And now she's a functioning person. She said, "I know it's winter time, but I went out in my garden and I gardened," because she hadn't gardened for 5 years. Her MSQ scores, when she came in, were way up around 30. They went down to 5. And so here's a lady, she just feels, we gave 20 years back to her life. And so that's very rewarding. And it's done with just the tools that we know from functional medicine, approaching this from a multifaceted approach, and just listening to the story, and then piece by piece, trying to separate the environmental influence on her susceptible genes so that we change the proteins, actually, the inflammatory proteins. We are changing how the body responds. And that's, and just, to me, this is where it's at.
Well, Jack, this is obviously so compelling. I'm sure that anyone listening to this for the first time who has not had any experience with functional medicine is just sitting there just amazed at this story. And, of course, those who have been in functional medicine probably have case histories that are similar that they would say, yeah, I've had those kind of successes. So with this in mind, it raises a question which it probably is an unanswerable question, but I'd like to get your opinion from more than 30 years' experience in medicine that you have, and that is, why do you think there's resistance to this concept in traditional medicine? It seems like it's non-toxic. It seems like it's safe. It seems like it doesn't necessarily prohibit the application of other intervention modalities. So why the resistance?
I think it has to do with perspective. And that was one of the biggest things that I had to change going from a surgeon to functional medicine. It isn't a matter of changing the science. It's a matter how you change your perspective and your interpretation of the science. From my lectures, I know we've all seen that picture where you look at a picture and it's either a glass or it's two faces looking at each other or it's either the old lady or the young lady. And it depends on how you look. The picture flips back and forth to a different picture. And yet the data in that picture didn't change. What changed is how we look at it, how we perceive the data. And I think that's the problem. I think people who are doing functional medicine perceive the data in a much broader interpretation. Unfortunately, I think that traditional medicine perceives data from a very narrow point of view, and especially within a specialty. The focus is very, very narrow, and they have a real hard time making their binoculars into a wider view to see outside their box. You know, the funny thing is, this stuff is in the literature, but traditional medicine is 20 years practice behind what is coming out in their own literature. And I think that's where the problem is. And I think that, you know, not to get into political and stuff, but I think medicine is now being, my own personal opinion, is being funded. Medicine is being funded by the pharmaceutical company. That's where the money comes to run medical schools. That's where the money comes for all the research, and it's biased. I mean, the stuff we use is stuff off the shelf. It's simple things, simple approaches. I mean, one of the patients that we did is getting Remicade, and I think that's, what, $3,000 per dose or something like that, IV. And when we're giving folic acid, what is that, 25 cents a dose? It's just it's a change of perspective. When I talk to my physicians, it's amazing. They go, huh, I never thought of that. So what's happening is they never thought of another scenario outside of their little box. That's one of the things I've noticed.
Well, I want to tell you, this has certainly been one of the most enchanting discussions that I've had the privilege of having on Functional Medicine Update, because what you brought is clinical insight from the reality of what they call the trenches. Sometimes we get caught up, I certainly do, in the esotericism of this mechanism and that mechanism and great technology breakthroughs in our understanding of how the body works, but it really all eventually distills down to how that patient behaves in the world in which they live and how they present themselves. And I think you've done just a magnificent job of making this complex story sensible and understandable. If someone was maybe thinking about functional medicine, they listened to this interview, I have a suspicion they're willing to invest the time to gain some mastery, because this is pretty motivating.
Jeff, another thing which I really want to let everybody know is that there's a huge latent period between when patients start having symptoms that is on a slippery, slidey slope towards autoimmune disease. I think this is very similar to what we found with diabetes and now with syndrome X or metabolic syndrome. There is a syndrome, and I've called it the inflammatory immune syndrome, that happens years and years before they actually get the four criterion to be labeled, for example, lupus. And if you listen to their story, and these patients go from doctor to doctor and they're given Paxil because they think they're just depressed. We have a golden opportunity as functional medicine practitioners to intervene with a potentially devastating disease years before there is actually physiological damage. And I think we can intervene in a way that actually stops the process. So, I mean, this is a whole new field of how do we get in early, before the patient actually comes in with gnarled up hands or, like in the patients with scleroderma, tissue, skin that looks like leather. How do we get into these patients early and prevent this whole process from ever happening? That's, I think, where the future is going to be exciting.
Well, I can't thank you enough for spending the time with us today. This is very motivational, and we'll take the lead and continue to try to inform people about this emerging inflammatory immune syndrome that you've described. And Jack, thanks a million for being part of the Function Medicine family. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much.
It struck me in thinking about the extraordinary comments that Dr. Kornbird made that when we start looking at this functional medicine model from 30,000 feet, kind of a broad brush evaluation, the approach is very different from that of the traditional differential diagnostic approach, which is to try to know more and more about less and less so that you can ultimately get a specific diagnosis. The functional medicine assessment, as Dr. Kornbird so eloquently described, is to really keep moving up to higher levels of organizational perspective to look at where the interconnections occur, and then from that drill down into the individual mechanisms of action related to each of these kind of nodes on the matrix. And so I think there's this kind of sense that we're moving back and forth between a telescope and a microscope with the functional medicine model, so that you get a broader base perspective and then a very small perspective, and you develop a personalized approach for the patient based upon the interrelationship between that connection of the whole and then focusing your therapeutic energies into implementation to the individual components. That then leads us to ask the question, what is one of the most important general themes that all air-breathing organisms need to concern themselves about as it relates to dysfunction? And of course, that's oxygen. It's about 20% of the air we breathe. And oftentimes we forget about air and water as being very important parts of any therapy. Every traditional form of healing from the dawn of the first medicine had something to do with delivering air or oxygen to tissues. It could be deep breathing, yogic exercise, various types of physical medicine or dance, in any number of things, up through aerobic exercise, and then later into mechanical intubation. So what we're really talking about is making sure that oxygen delivery and respiratory gases are properly controlled, because low levels of oxygen in a tissue produces oxidative stress, and in fact, it's associated with inflammation. It's associated with tissue injury. And so you want to make sure that tissues are properly oxygenated and that person is delivering oxygen to things like the monooxygenase enzymes, which are the cytochrome P450s, these various detoxification enzymes that we've talked about that require oxygen for their activity and for proper function to detoxify endogenous and exogenous toxins. We also talk about water as a very important part, because hydration is critically important for establishing appropriate environmental conditions within cells and tissues and organs to do their function. Dehydration increases the solute concentration and changes the enzyme function and changes cellular activity and membrane transport. So proper hydration becomes an extraordinarily important part of any therapy, and making sure that you get proper balance of intra and extracellular fluids. And many patients who are on medications, by the nature of those medications, may alter their intra and extracellular fluid balance and then be suffering from intracellular dehydration. So it's, again, an important part of a therapy. Anyone that's overdone alcohol sometime in their early history recalls the effect that excess alcohol has on intracellular hydration, how it produces a dehydration effect and makes you very thirsty because your cells actually become dehydrated, and as a consequence, you start getting these toxic symptoms. So I just wanted to make sure we recognize that sometimes the simplest things become the most important in a patient. Proper breathing and delivery of oxygen and proper fluid intake and intracellular hydration. That then obviously ties together again with the topics that Dr. Kornbird was speaking about as part of the matrix, concepts of gastrointestinal function, immunological function, hepatic detoxification function, oxidant balance or redox balance, as we call it, reduction oxidation, neuroendocrine balance, body-mind balance. These all interrelate as components of the web in the matrix to things as simple as proper delivery of oxygen and proper fluid intake. So what we have outlined in the course of this last 80 minutes is a model that has sprung out of the nearly now 20 years of emergence and evolution of functional medicine. it really paves the way, I think, for increased application of this model to a variety of different chronic complex disorders that don't fit necessarily into a tidy diagnostic profile. And obviously, again, as I hold in my hand as we close this episode, as I hold the textbook of functional medicine, relates to the themes and concepts described in this 800-page real embodiment of the spirit of what we've been talking about for nearly 20 years. So I hope you'll have a chance to read the textbook of functional medicine and really spend some time gaining the kind of mastery of this technique that allow you to help your patients more effectively. Thanks so much for being with us.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted to Synthesis by Jeffrey Bland. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.